You're listening to A Conduit's Diary, a podcast by me, Rachel, about my life as a conduit. These stories do have cuss words, so be sure to keep the little ears away. And also like and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And without further ado, here is episode 51. That's not my family. 4:25 a.m. from Mitchell Hunt at redacted.net. Rachel, I got your information from name redacted. Something very strange is happening in my house and I need a professional's opinion. Please call me at blank. Thanks. Mitchell. 5:45 a.m. from Mitchell Hunt at redacted.net. Rachel, I don't mean to sound impatient. I work nights, so I know not everyone is awake this time of night, but I need you to call me the minute you get this email. It's very important. Sincerely, Mitchell. 7:25 a.m. from Mitchell Hunt at redacted.net. Please call me immediately. Things have escalated. Mitchell. 9:25 a.m. from Mitchell Hunt at redacted.net. This isn't a joke. I need you to reach out to me immediately. All caps. You don't need to be an empath to feel the desperation coming through the email on this one. It's a brisk November morning at that weird time in Phoenix where it's almost cold in the morning and then right back to too warm in the afternoons. Dressing appropriately at 7 a.m. means you'll be sweating your ass off by 11 a.m. There really is no way to prepare. On cool mornings like this, I try to be awake as early as I can so I can get out to the rescue and get things rolling before it's too hot. Dogs that can't go outside in the summer heat get priority when it's the coolest, stretching out in the fenced-off grass area after a bout of zoomies. This is me time, where I don't read my email or respond to text or anything. I just sit and enjoy the quiet before the day starts and the chaos begins. It's 9:20 a.m. when I finally open my email. I'm not one of those gals who gets rid of her alerts. My phone is covered in unanswered notifications. My emails waiting to be read is in the hundreds. Still, it's not hard to miss Mitchell's train of desperate emails, all starting at 4:25 that morning. I'm about to call him when the last email comes across. This isn't a joke. I need you to reach out to me immediately. Point taken. Mitchell answers on the second ring. Hello? He's breathless, hopeful. It's a bad sign. Hi, is this Mitchell? I ask. Who's asking? He replies, short, curt. My name is Rachel. I got your... Oh, thank God. Honey, it's Rachel. Yes, Rachel from the email that... Name redacted. Recommended? An even worse sign. Listen, I need you to come as soon as possible. Today, even. This afternoon is preferable. Oh, well, I start. Name your price. I know you're expensive, but if you get this, if you fix this, it's all worth it. He breathes. How do you say no to that? By noon, I'm parking my car in front of a typical suburban house in Tempe. It's a little older, like most homes in Tempe, with a carport instead of a garage. The street is almost empty this time of day, and it's easy to find a spot in front of the home. Maybe it was impulsive of me to go straight to the home without the appropriate amount of research, but the dude sounded terrified. I texted Emma the address I'm at and leave my location services on, just in case. After going to Tucson, I've become somewhat paranoid. The door swings open after a single knock, and I'm ushered into the space. It opens into a living room with older carpet and wood paneling. On the wall behind the couch is a cross and a ton of old family photos, the glass a bit dingy and fogged with age. An older TV sits on a makeshift entertainment system, currently turned on to CNN, but muted. The man that greets me is short and round, his face red under his darker complexion. He's wearing scrubs, but no name tag and no embroidery. "Thank you for coming so fast," he says, motioning me into the other room. "My friend is letting us stay here for the meantime, but we need to figure something out before it's too late." He's winded by the time we reach the kitchen, and he pulls out a chair for me to sit. A booster seat is in the chair next to me, which he gingerly sets on the ground before sinking into it. "So, this isn't the house?" I ask, chancing another glance around the kitchen. It's just as dated as the rest of the home, but very comfortable. It lacks the sterile feeling most of my clients go for, and it's definitely not haunted. At least, not by anything malicious. It's calming. Peaceful. A jarring difference from the sweating man sitting next to me. "No," he answers, then takes a deep breath. "What do you know about mimics?" I almost laugh. A mimic? Someone has been playing too much D&D or watching too many Marvel movies. Mimics are exceedingly rare, mostly because of the power it takes for them to mimic someone else. For one to cross into this realm and take hold is, well, it's laughable. "You think you have a mimic?" I ask, instead of answering his question. He nods. "It started yesterday morning. I work nights. I'm a nurse." He points to his scrubs. "We have an 18-month-old, and he has a baby cam in his room. I miss him, you know, so I check on it from time to time. It's early morning, maybe 3 a.m., and there's an alert for movement in his room. I pull up the app, and he's sitting on the edge of the bed with my wife. They're staring at the door. At first, I think it's kind of cute. Our son is a bit of a daddy's boy, and my wife can't always get him to go to bed or calm down. The fact that she was in there with him was nice, like they're getting closer. Except, it gets weird. The longer I watch, the more I realize they're not talking. They're just sitting there, staring at the door to his room. I close out of the app and call my wife. She doesn't answer for a few rings. I figure it's because her phone is in the bedroom and she's in our son's room. But when she answers, she's groggy, like I've woken her up. She asks me if everything is okay, and I ask her the same thing. She says our son, Darren, woke her up and wanted to crawl into bed with her a bit ago. She was just about to fall back asleep when the phone rang. She was almost asleep to the point where she thought the phone was ringing in her dream. I ask her if she's been in our son's room. She tells me no. I tell her to look at the camera because I just saw her in there with our son. She grumbles something and I hear the phone shift. I put her on speakerphone so I can open the app again, make sure I'm not seeing anything. Sure enough, the image is the same. My wife and son are sitting on his bed, except this time they're staring at the camera. She must have seen it too because she gasps, literally gasps, and tells me to hold on. She hangs up the phone and I kind of lost it. I try to call her over and over again, but she's not answering. Finally, she does. It must have been minutes, but it felt like hours. I was about to call my superior and leave my entire ward understaffed because I was so worried. She finally answers and tells me she grabbed Darren and they're in the car leaving. She said she went by her son's room and the door was cracked. So she looked in and there they were, spitting images of her and Darren staring right at her. She freaked out and slammed the door to the room, shut it, and booked it. So now we've confirmed it's not some weird loop, though I don't think a loop would make sense. Every time I check the camera overnight, they were just staring at the wall or the camera. They breathed and blinked like normal people. They just didn't move. Finally, my shift is up. My coworker and I head back to my house. We go to grab our bats, we're on a softball league together, and go inside. It looks like my wife left in a hurry, just like she said. We walk around the downstairs, and as we're doing it, the board creaks on the steps. I look up and it's my wife walking down the stairs. Except it's not my wife because I'd just spoken to her and she was at my coworker's house. She stops halfway down the stairs and smiles at us. We book it. Well, I booked it. My coworker paused, confused. He grabbed me and told me to chill, that it was just Marnie, my wife. I told him, "That's not my wife." The thing laughs. She says, in my wife's voice, "You always have the best imagination. Darren and I played a little trick on you. Isn't that right?" Then the Darren lookalike walks down the stairs and smiles and nods. But I know it's not them. "How?" I ask. "I just knew. Haven't you ever been in love? You know when something is off, when something doesn't feel right. That wasn't my wife, and that sure as hell wasn't my kid. So I say that. I say, you can't fool me. I know you're not them." The wife thing frowns, clearly angry. "If you're my wife," I say, "then where did we go for our honeymoon?" "Cancun," she says. She's right. It's the truth, but it's an easy one, you know? Anyone who's been studying us would know that. So I try to think of something deeper, something that only she would know. I said, "Okay, what movie did we go on our first date?" She laughs and says, "That's so long ago. How am I supposed to remember?" That's when I knew I got her. His eyes light in triumph. "Because she couldn't remember the movie you saw on your first date?" I ask. "Exactly. Because we didn't go to a movie. We went to prom. That was our first date. It's a running joke between her and I, and we don't tell a lot of people about it because it's kind of embarrassing. Well, the backstory is. Anyway, it's proof that it wasn't her. I was going to take a swing, but my coworker grabbed me. He thought I was losing it. So he took me back to his house, and my wife and son were there. He was shocked, of course. He said, 'You were just at the house.' I thought my wife was going to pass out right there and then. Darren was in the living room, and he came and gave me a big hug. He said, 'You saw them too?'" "Yikes," I breathed. "Yeah, I know. He said he was woken up from sleep by the sound of my wife's voice. He thought it was her, but then he saw himself too. Thinking it was a nightmare, he ran into our room to sleep with my wife, which triggered the camera, which alerted me to it. If I hadn't looked and woken her up..." He trailed off and shook his head. "This was yesterday?" I asked. He nodded. "And they're still there?" "Yes, here." He pulled out his phone and pulled up his photos. He started to scroll through videos, screenshots of his camera app. One showed his son's room with the replica of his wife and son sitting on the bed, staring at the door. Another showed the kitchen, where the replica of his wife walked a circle around the island in their kitchen. The video length was 4 hours. Another looked like it was from the doorbell camera, where his son stood on the front porch of their house, barefoot, staring into the street. He kept scrolling through them, shaking his head. "See? See how weird they look? I'm worried they're going to draw the attention of the neighbors, and someone's going to call the police." "Why haven't you?" I asked. "Usually people get the police involved before they reach out to me, though Mitchell seemed to have some idea of the paranormal. He even called them mimics, not aliens or body snatchers." "And say what? There's a mimic in my house pretending to be my wife and son? They'd cart me away or explain it away. The police don't do paranormal. I know that firsthand. The hospital I work at, it's haunted. We all know it. But anytime a patient calls the police, they don't even bother coming. Said too many false alarms." He rolls his eyes and throws his hand up to harp on his point. "And they've done all this in 24 hours?" I asked. It was an impressive feat of strength, though I know Mitchell won't see it that way. "Yes, given more time, I'm not sure what else they could do," he says ominously. "And it's been 24 hours since you were last in the home?" I asked. He nods. "Okay, good," I say. "Good? How so?" "Well, they feed off their intended target. It's likely that they've been around you for a while, watching your wife and son." "Does your wife work from home?" I ask. "Yes, she does. Darren spends most of his time at home, though he does go to daycare at a friend's house a few times a month. They're almost always home." "You think that's how they got them and not me?" He leans forward in his seat as he speaks, his eyes wide. "Possibly," I say, leaning back unconsciously. "Mimics need a lot of energy to get to this side. Has your wife been feeling tired lately? Your son seemed moody?" "I have," comes a voice from the doorway. The spitting image of the woman in the videos stands in the threshold, her arms crossed over her chest. She has black circles under both eyes, which are red-rimmed and puffy, "You're Rachel?" she asks skeptically. "I am. It's nice to meet you." I trail off, already forgetting what Mitchell said her name was. "Marnie," she says, pushing off the doorframe to sit at the table with us, sitting next to her husband and away from me. "You asked if I've been tired lately. Well, yeah. It's getting close to the end of Q4. I'm really hustling. We had some layoffs, so I've had to take on extra work." It's a flimsy explanation, but I don't say so. "And Darren?" I asked. "He's almost two. They call it the terrible twos for a reason," she says. This time, she doesn't sound as convinced. "So he's been combative?" I ask. Marnie chances a glance at Mitchell, who shrugs before continuing on. "Reclusive, more like it. We're going to have an assessment with a child psych at my hospital soon, if he got worse. Hides in his room, doesn't engage. Sometimes he's just zoned out. When we ask him to do something he doesn't want to do, I don't recognize him." "What do you think is going on?" I ask Marnie. "I don't know. Something really messed up. When I saw them the other night, it was wrong. Something felt so wrong, but also it was familiar. I don't know how to explain it," she adds, curling her arms tighter around her waist. Mitchell places a hand on her shoulder and pulls her into him, hugging her tight. "Can you help us?" he asks. "Feels like I don't have a choice." Mitchell stops his car in front of his home, his knuckles white on the steering wheel. "You sure you don't want me to go in with you?" he asks. "Nah, I'll be fine," I tell him. What I don't say is that the mimic will feed on him, and I need it weak. The great thing about being a conduit is that I'm not fully in one realm or the other at any point in time, meaning they can't siphon off me. I also can see them coming from a mile away and dodge them, but that's besides the point. "How long will it take?" he asks. "Tell you what, if you haven't heard from me in 45 minutes, you can come in. Bring the bat," I add, nodding to the aluminum bat in the back seat. He grins and puts the car into park. "Your countdown starts now." The front door is unlocked and swings open easily. The home is newer, a two-story townhome with a small side yard in a cramped neighborhood. It's the way homes are going in Phoenix. Small lots, building upright, cramming as many people into a space as possible. I cross the foyer into the living room, where the mimic is currently sitting. This close, I can see that there isn't two of them, just one, fractured to produce two images. Depending on how I look at them, I either see their earth form or their true form, which is helpful, because I know how weak they are. Their true form is a gross approximation of what a mimic demon should look like. It's lounging on the couch, its long arms sprawled all the way along the back of the seat. I can't tell what color demon it is because it's just not quite here enough to be opaque. Instead, I see more of the couch cushion than them. They must be using all their energy to project, which is sad. "First time?" I ask, standing in the entrance to the living room. "What?" it says. Marnie's mouth moves, but I can hear its true voice, a whisper more than anything else. "First time trying to mimic someone?" I repeat, raising an eyebrow. "No," it says, "but I know better. I can see its true face," which blanches at my words. While its vision of Marnie and Darren don't break their pained smile, the demon is upset. Sure. I'd give you tips, but then you'd just come back, and that's annoying for me," I say. "Profitable, but annoying," I add silently. I wonder if any of my ancestors did that, or if I was the first to exchange my services for money. I'll worry about that when I die. "Come back? Oh, I'm not going anywhere," it says. It talks a big game, which isn't uncommon for demons that end up on this side of things. They get too big for their britches over there, and something like this happens, where they either have to prove themselves or leave so they don't get murdered in their realm. Sad, really. Most demons that came to Earth are kind of losers. Well, it's been 24 hours without anyone to siphon energy from, unless you've been snacking on a neighbor, I add. It narrows its eyes at me, and Marnie and Darren follow suit. "So, you're right here," it says, jumping up and closing the distance between us in a few quick strides. It stops in front of me and I can feel it trying and failing to get anything from me. When it doesn't work, it reaches out to grab my wrist, hoping that skin-to-skin contact will work. "What?" it starts, before realization dawns on its face. "You're the conduit," it says, and I really enjoy the note of fear in its voice. I'm getting kind of sick of either being sneered at or insinuated that someone is after me. True, cold fear is much better. "And you've outstayed your welcome," I say, turning my hand over to grab its wrist in return. The moment my fingers close over it, the demon shrieks, which nearly breaks my concentration. Instead, I double down, focusing my energy to drag the demon down with me from this plane to the next. It doesn't take much. It was already weak when I got here, and it used too much energy trying to keep up its facade. It claws at my wrist as we sink through the floor of this world and into the next, passing into the purplish ochre of the next world. The world turns from our bright hues to the muted grays of the other. When the demon sees this, it shrieks again, but quieter. In this realm, noise doesn't travel the same way. It's like being underwater. I don't let go until its head disappears into the division. Its eyes are wide, helpless, as it slips under. I give it one last smile before I shove it under, closing the portal just as I resurface. The room is silent, and the mimic is gone. "What the hell was that noise?" Mitchell asks from the doorway. He's got his bat in hand, poised over his head, ready to strike. "A mimic being banished," I say, examining my hand. There's red rings in the shape of long, demon fingers around my wrist, and my palm is covered in that thick purple goo, but I'm otherwise unharmed. "You got a plastic bag or something?" I ask. He nods and scurries into the kitchen, returning with a gallon-sized freezer bag. "What is that?" he asks. "Not sure," I say. "Been seeing it more and more. Figured I should give it someone to look at it." "So, they're gone?" he asks, looking around the empty living room. I nod as I wipe the last of the goo into the bag. "Yep, hopefully they won't bother you again," I add. "Can they get back in the way they came?" he asks. I pick my bag up off the floor and rifle through it, pulling out a few items that Hema gave me just for these situations. "Keep these by the front and back door," I say, handing off a few crystals. "And this one on your nightstand, this one on your son's nightstand. If anything weird happens, just call me." "I can't thank you enough," he says. "I accept cash or check," I reply.
A Conduit's Diary is created by me, written and produced by me, mixed horribly and edited by me. Cover art created by BMC Design on Fiverr. Music, intro and outro, created by Chris Hornberger.